Hello, listeners. Welcome to Stars of the Golden Age, a show that highlights the lives of legends from film, music, and the birth of television during Hollywood's Golden Age, with a special emphasis on their lives behind the scenes. I am your host, Erin Carlson. Today, we will be talking about Bea Arthur. You guys, Maud scares the daylights out of me. Dorothy's Bornak scares the daylights out of me. I imagine myself crumbling into a pile of submissiveness if Bea Arthur were still with us and I were lucky enough to be in her presence. And I am not alone in this mindset. A lot of people feel that way. Bea Arthur's characters are a force. We feel it in every character she brought to us. The ones I've seen, at least. But Bea Arthur was not Maud. She was not Dorothy. She was Bea Arthur, who was actually quite different from her most iconic characters. Her Golden Girls co-star, Rue McClanahan, said this of her. Quote, "The real Bea Arthur is nothing like the domineering character she plays on TV. Everyone asks me, what is Bea Arthur like? Do you get along all right? Or does she scare you to death? And I say, scared? What are you talking about?" End quote. Along the same lines, super producer Norman Lear said, quote, "The character she plays in The Golden Girls is 180 degrees from the quiet, reticent woman that Bea Arthur is in real life." End quote. I feel like the following words are nothing unusual, and a billion people say these very same words. But I am one of the biggest Golden Girls fans. I remember watching it in real time back in the late 80s and early 90s, the later seasons at least. I was just a kid. Saturday night on NBC, watching it with my family, most of the jokes going right over my little child head. But I loved them anyways. And I've seen every single episode at least a dozen times since, maybe more. Some of them I can fully recite and will be able to until the day I die. The Golden Girls is my comfort show. I've said it before, but I don't watch TV. But if I came down with the flu today, it would be Dorothy, Rose, Blanche, and Sophia that I would be seeking out to make me feel better. There is just no show like it. The Golden Girls is just so dang special. After the Golden Girls said goodbye to us, how dare they, I watched reruns, and I also watched Maud and the Mary Tyler Moore Show, where I could still be comforted by Bea Arthur, Rue McClanahan, and Betty White. Sometimes Rue and Betty on Mama's Family, too, but my brother threatened to tell everybody at school one day that I watched Mama's Family, so I had to proceed with great caution on that one. Anyways, I love all those girls so much. I know when we think of the Golden Age of Hollywood or classic Hollywood cinema, our minds don't go right to Bea Arthur. She wasn't gracing the silver screen during the 1940s. She was busy on the stage. But she was born the same year as Ava Gardner. She was born the same year as Doris Day. She was born the same year as Eleanor Parker, Betty White, and Judy Garland. Still, I feel a bit like I'm cheating by covering her since she didn't have a movie or television career in the time period we usually discuss. She was a stage actress. But I'm doing her anyways because I love her and I want you all to know her story. What I could find of her story, that is. So, it is my great, great honor to shine our light this week on the marvelous Bea Arthur. Bea Arthur was born as Bernice Frankel on May 13, 1922, in Brooklyn, New York, to parents Philip and Rebecca. Philip had immigrated from Poland and Rebecca from Austria. Bea was the middle child of three daughters for the couple. She had an older sister named Gertrude and a younger sister named Marion. Bea was a shy and sensitive little girl. She never really felt like she fit in. She was very tall, so she stood out in a crowd. But she didn't want to stand out in a crowd. So she used humor as a shield. She was the class clown, and she loved impersonating her favorite movie stars. Her favorite being Mae West. Sources vary, but when Bea was between 7 and 11 years old, the Frankel family relocated to the seaside town of Cambridge, Maryland, and opened a clothing store. With this move, Bea ditched the name Bernice because it was also the name of several boys in town, and she did not like that. She couldn't stand her name, so she buried it and moved on. From that point on, she either went by Beatrice or Bea. The Frankel family was one of the only Jewish families in Cambridge, but they were very happy there. Bea participated in as many school plays as she could, looking for that creative outlet. But she mostly played male roles since she was so tall. She was just happy to be performing, but she wished for nothing more than to be a cute little petite blonde girl. When Bea was 16 years old, she was diagnosed with a serious blood disorder in which her blood would not clot properly. To be in a safer place while living with this condition, she was sent to a boarding school for her last 2 years of high school. Once she was well, she returned home, but she knew she didn't want to stay in Cambridge. She wanted to go to college. She wanted to make something of her life. She enrolled in the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia and began studies to be a medical technician. After her summer internship, though, she quickly realized this wasn't the path for her. As she put it herself, quote, "I thought, I'm not happy running errands. I really am not. I want to be a star. That's what I really want to be," end quote. After convincing her parents that giving up her future in the medical field for a potentially challenging life in acting, Bea auditioned for the dramatic workshop at the New School in New York City. She was accepted, and she set off for her new life all by herself in the big city. She described her first apartment like this. Quote, "I had a cold water flat, which I paid $15 a month, with a toilet out in the hall and a bathtub in the kitchen next to the sink. And it was the most exciting time of my life, because there I was in New York," end quote. No hot water, and she was the happiest she'd ever been. Her happiness rose to new heights when she fell in love with a young playwright named Robert Allen Arthur, a future star himself. He went on to become a very successful screenwriter and director. Bea wouldn't be around to see it, though. The two were married in 1944 and divorced about 5 years later. Being a private person, Bea never shared too much about this marriage. What she did say much later in life, though, was, quote, "I think a lot of it had to do, again, with getting out of the Eastern Shore of Maryland, not really knowing what I wanted. And then, of course, I realized, no, I want a career, and I want to be a starlet, and nothing is going to stand in my way," end quote. I need to interject here in the story Bea Arthur wanted known about her life. Because around this point, there's a really important part of her story that, for some reason, she never wanted known while she was alive. She flat out denied it, actually. But evidence now exists that Bernice Frankel was enlisted with the United States Marine Corps Women's Reserve during World War II. The Marine Corps Women's Reserve was formed on February 13, 1943, and Bea Frankel joined just 5 days after its formation at 20 years old. A letter written by Bea to a friend on February 23, 1943 has been recovered, and it says, quote, "I soon realized I didn't care for lab work at all, so I came to New York. I heard last week that enlistment for women in the Marines was now open, so I decided the only thing to do was join," end quote. Further evidence that has come to light shows that Bea reported for duty on March 26, 1943. Upon arrival, she underwent physical and emotional evaluations. She was described as, quote, "alert, trim, and neither positive nor negative. Her speech is fluent and distinct. Her general behavior is ingratiating, frank, and open, end quote. B was promoted to private first class of the U.S. Marine Corps on May 1, 1943, and her rank was eventually elevated to staff sergeant. She was stationed at Camp Lejeune in North Carolina and worked primarily as a military truck driver. She was honorably discharged on September 26, 1945, after 2.5 years of service. I do need to point out that some sources now say that B met and married Robert Arthur while enlisted in the Marine Corps, that he was also enlisted and that's how they met. But her story always remained that they met in the New York theater circles. The evidence suggests they met while enlisted. So why did B. Arthur deny her military history? Why did she never talk about it? Well, that's anyone's guess. Maybe she was just stepping in to help her country because she thought it was the right thing to do, and she didn't see it as a very big deal. Or maybe her later involvement with liberal and progressive causes made her keep her military ties quiet. Her sons have been asked about their mother's veteran status, of course, and they are just as much in the dark as the rest of the world. Her son Daniel said she never talked about it. The only thing she would say was that she could drive any vehicle. So, B. Arthur, my goddess, I am so sorry to share this part of your story that you very clearly did not want to be told. Please forgive me. To me, this just shows how amazing a woman B. Arthur was. Not only did she step up and serve her country when it needed her most, but she did so without expectation of praise or glory. She did it, she rocked it, and she moved on. But to us, she is a true hero. Back to Bee's acting aspirations. Her talent had really excelled at the dramatic workshop, and her height and deep voice had her continually placed in grand classical roles. The sheer presence of her was striking, and she was working extremely hard to become a great actress. She also began to sing. She got a job at a nightclub called the Blue Angel, but singing didn't seem to be Bee's calling. That striking presence that fit so well in many of the dramatic roles that she was doing in the theater seemed to be working against her on the nightclub stage. But the nightclub owner had some advice for her. She should try comedy. In 1947, when Bee was 25 years old, she and a group of peers from the dramatic workshop formed their own off-Broadway theater company. It was within this group that Bee found love again with a talented young actor named Gene Sachs. He was fun, he was funny, he had drive. Bee was hooked. But she still wanted to hang on to her independence. She did not want to lose track of her goals. Gene convinced Bee to get married anyways. She loved Gene and she wanted to be with him. And it had gotten to the point where she would lose him if she didn't go all in. So in 1950, she went all in. She married Gene. And she didn't regret it. Bee kept busy with touring and variety shows, honing in her comedic skill. In 1953, she was cast in her first real comedic leading role in an off-Broadway musical, The Three Penny Opera. "That changed my life completely," Bee later said of this breakthrough role. "Once you hear a laugh like that, there's no stopping it. Since then, I just love playing comedy." And it was at this point when things really started to happen for Bee. Everything began falling into place in a precisely perfect manner for her. Just the very next year, in a comedy sketch production called Shoestring Review, a very important man was sitting amongst the audience one evening. Well, a future very important man. A man named Norman Lear, who, of course, would go on to achieve great success in television production and be a very important figure in Bee Arthur's career. In the meantime, however, Bee was staying as busy as ever in her stage work. She was doing anything she could to build on her comedic skills, and she was having a blast in the process. In 1956, Bea was chosen to be part of the cast of a revival of the Ziegfeld Follies, and the understudy of its star, the great Tallulah Bankhead. Bea was so thrilled and honored to work with a legend like Tallulah Bankhead. She was awestruck with her grand stage presence. When Bea shared this with Miss Bankhead, how remarkable she thought she was, her reply was not exactly favorable. What Tallulah Bankhead said to Bea Arthur was this: "I know what you were thinking when you watched me walk down that grand staircase, that it could never be you. You have the talent, you see. It's a matter of bone structure." And this pissed Bea Arthur right off. How dare she thought. She would show Tallulah Bankhead. This encounter just gave Bea more fuel to achieve great success. She was going to be a star.
What is art without the muse? Many of Western art's most famous works are depictions of women. But who were these women? Do they have their own stories to share with the world? Hi, listeners. Grace Anna here, host of Art Muse, a podcast that shares the life stories of the women pictured in famous works of art. In doing so, Art Muse aims to reshape the ways in which we interpret these well-known works by paying dues to the women whose images have been immortalized, but whose names and stories have been wrongfully overlooked. Each episode focuses our attention on a specific female muse, sharing their important life and legacy. By sharing these women's stories, we are given the opportunity to appreciate artworks from a new perspective, through the eyes of the women whose image stares back at us. Season 3 continues to share the life stories of the women pictured in famous works of art, this time focusing on artist models who were also performers in their own right. Season 3 will begin its release this fall. We cannot wait to share these amazing women's stories with you. In the meantime, we hope you continue to enjoy Season 1 and 2 of Art Muse, available on all streaming platforms. Until next time, bye for now.
Norman Lear never forgot about Bea Arthur. Her tall, grandiose presence and her deep, funny presentation of her lines was unforgettable. He knew if she had made such an impression on him, she had to do the same to others. His own career was growing fast with the growth and evolution of television in the early 1950s, and he wanted to showcase Bea somehow. He started on a sketch comedy show that he was one of the directors on, The George Gobel Show. Many famous faces appeared as guests on that show during its six-year run, including Hedy Lamarr, Myrna Loy, Jimmy Stewart, Fred McMurray, Angela Lansbury, Henry Fonda, Mickey Rooney, Kirk Douglas, Boris Karloff, so many. And now, in 1959, Bea Arthur was not only asked to appear on the show, but she was asked to be a regular cast member. Unfortunately, the show ended just a handful of episodes after Bea joined the cast. Norman wasn't done with Bea Arthur, though. Bea and Jean's marriage was going strong, and in 1961, they were ready to add a little more love to their home. They adopted their first child, a son named Matthew, and 2 years later, they adopted another little boy, Daniel. Everyone who knew Bea, including her children, said she was an absolutely wonderful mother. She stepped back a little bit from work after she became a mother so she could focus more on the boys. She wanted them to have as happy and typical childhood as possible. Her boys were her number one priority. The family was doing well enough where they could have a comfortable apartment in Manhattan and a country home in upstate New York. And that is where Bea felt the happiest. She was at peace at their country home, surrounded by her family. The family dynamic and their financial situation shifted unexpectedly in 1964 when Bea's husband, Gene, became very sick. He had built his own career up very well, also appearing a lot on television and performing steadily on Broadway. But when he became ill, it was first reported as hepatitis, but later said to be another kind of liver ailment. Bea became the sole breadwinner for the family. So she was cast on Broadway in Fiddler on the Roof and stayed with the production for a year while Gene recovered. Once Gene was well again, he began stepping into the role of director a little more. In 1966, he was brought on to direct Mame on Broadway. This was huge. Angela Lansbury was cast as Mame, and for the role of Mame's best friend Vera, it was Bea Arthur. Both women won Tony Awards for their performances. Angela Lansbury for Best Actress and Bea Arthur for Best Supporting Actress. Bea was happy and grateful for this success, for having this prominent role in a huge, successful Broadway production, and for winning a Tony Award for it. She was proud. She worked her butt off to get to where she was. But she wasn't completely satisfied. She was going to work her way to the top. Those words of Tallulah Bankhead never left her mind. She knew her physical appearance and her deep baritone voice was the obstacle blocking her from being a star. That only meant she would have to work harder. She was going to make her way to the top. She was going to be the star, and she was taking her tall frame and her deep voice with her. While Bea was set to achieve her professional goals on Broadway, her husband Gene had begun directing movies, which had him in Los Angeles often. Bea was happy in New York, well, Gene was too, and she wanted to keep a normal routine for their boys, so she stayed out east while Gene worked on his films in LA. But then, Norman Lear came calling again. By this time, Norman Lear had really made a name for himself through a television show that he had developed. A television show that would go down in history as being one of the most popular and iconic television shows ever made. All in the Family. By season 2 of All in the Family, it was a massive hit, and Norman Lear called on his friend Bea Arthur to appear on the show. She was hesitant. She wasn't sure she wanted to uproot the kids and go to LA, even if it was just for a short time to fulfill this part. She didn't like flying, and she just wasn't sure about taking the job. But Lear talked her into it. She flew to LA, and soon later, the world was introduced to Edith Bunker's cousin, Maude. And the rest is history. The character of Maude on All in the Family was so fantastic, well, Bea Arthur's delivery of Maude, that Norman Lear immediately began developing her own show. This character needed to have her own show, and nobody on earth could play the part other than Bea Arthur. It had taken a lot of convincing to get Bea out to LA for one episode of All in the Family. Starring in her own show would require her and the boys to pack up and move from New York to LA. Gene's work was primarily on Broadway, so it was a really big decision that could affect their family in many ways. Ultimately, Bea and Gene decided the show was too huge an opportunity to pass up. Bea and the boys would move to Los Angeles, and she would become Maude. Norman Lear and Bea Arthur had become very good friends since he first saw her on the stage in 1954. They had a similar drive for success and similar personalities. He said it like this, quote, "We shared a sense of madness. And you can't be mad in the way I mean mad without a deep, deep understanding of the human condition. And this is what made her so exquisitely funny," end quote. Let's talk about Maud, because this was a truly groundbreaking show. It covered some very taboo topics of its day, just like All in the Family. Divorce, women's rights, alcoholism, and the most taboo and groundbreaking topic presented on Maud, abortion. The two-part episode is titled Maud's Dilemma, and it aired in November of 1972 in season one of the show. Maud is 47 years old in the show, and her husband Walter is 49. And Maud learns at her annual exam with her doctor that she is pregnant. She has an adult daughter, she has a grandchild, and now she's pregnant herself. This is clearly not ideal at her point in life. They can financially support a child, but do they want to? The episode touches on some really important points. Why wasn't Maud taking birth control? Well, it makes her sick. This really is something that still isn't talked about. It can be really tough on women to take birth control. And why hadn't Walter had a vasectomy? Well, he was nervous, and it was just easier for Maud to take a pill. The pill that made her sick. It brought up the idea that the woman is often held with the burden of birth control. They talked about how, yes, abortion is legal in New York, and that it is something that Maud advocated for. But undergoing it herself was a whole different thing. Maud was a woman's rights advocate, but she still felt guilty about considering abortion. In the end, Maud had the abortion. As you can imagine, this was a very controversial storyline in 1972. It's a delicate topic today. It always will be. This was the first time abortion was talked about on primetime television. It incited protests, sponsors backed out, and some stations refused to air the episode. For the most part, Maud was applauded for bringing light to such issues, all of the real-life situations that they showcased on the show. Bea Arthur was pro-choice herself, but in the end, she still struggled with these episodes. It's very important to understand in Bea Arthur's story that Bea Arthur was not Maud. Maud was fierce and strong and outspoken and tough. Bea was tough, but she was gentle and sensitive and vulnerable and reserved. I think this is why she struggled with the attention the abortion episodes received, because she didn't like being at the center of controversy. She had her personal beliefs, and they were strong ones, but she was more of a quiet warrior. The great success of Maud had unfortunate effects on Bea and Jean's marriage. Until then, Jean had been the more successful of the two. He had built up a pretty impressive directing career, and his career had always taken the front seat. But now, with Maud, that balance was shifting, and it shifted very quickly. Maud was an overnight sensation, and Bea Arthur was a star. She was known nationwide, even farther. It would be a difficult thing to experience in any relationship where the two have grown in the same field. To make matters worse, Jean had decided to make the move to LA to support Bea's career, and he felt like he left his own behind on Broadway. In 1974, he directed Bea in the film rendition of Mame, where she revived her role as Vera Charles. Only this time, her sidekick Mame was played by the great Lucille Ball. Although the production had been a smash hit on Broadway, the film was a critical and box office disappointment. This failure only intensified Jean's resentment at leaving his career behind in New York. Bea and Jean loved and respected each other, but ultimately, it was the career contention that became the wedge that dug deeper and deeper until they didn't think they wanted to save the marriage. Bea and Jean got divorced in 1979 after almost 30 years of marriage. Maud ran on television for a highly successful 6 seasons. Bea Arthur was nominated for 5 Emmy Awards for her portrayal as Maud, and she won the Emmy for Best Actress in a Comedy Series in 1977. The following year, with the series flying as high as ever, Bea Arthur and Norman Lear came to a mutual decision that they should leave Maud high up on that pedestal and close the curtain on the series. Bow out while they were still on top. The final episode of Maud aired on April 22, 1978. Following her long run as Maud, Bee dabbled as a guest on a variety of television shows, she hosted award shows, and she even returned to Broadway. She wasn't necessarily wanting to jump into another full-time project. She was happy taking jobs here and there, and she was lucky enough to have the financial security to do so. But then, in late 1984, she heard from her agent that there was a script floating around for a new television show in the works that had the description of one of the main characters as, quote, a Bea Arthur type. She found this amusing and I'm sure somewhat flattering, but she wasn't interested in actually taking the job herself. But head writer Susan Harris was. And ironically, it was Susan Harris who had written the most iconic episode of Maud, the abortion episode. Susan Harris knew what a remarkable gem Bea Arthur was, and she knew she had to have her for this role in her new show. They had already hired Betty White, Estelle Getty, and Rue McClanahan. Rue had been Bea's co-star in Maud. Susan needed Rue's help. She begged her to call Bea and help convince her to take on this project. Bea still just wasn't much interested. She didn't really want to jump back into the hectic schedule of a weekly television show. But she said she would read the script. And when she read the script, when she saw the characters' descriptions and saw the hilarious writing for the pilot episode, she knew she couldn't say no to this. This was too good to turn her back on. Bea Arthur was going to be Dorothy Zbornak in The Golden Girls. Now, those of you out there who are diehard Golden Girls fans, could you pick a favorite episode? I mean, they are all just pure perfection. Well, except for that one that focuses on the crumbling marriage of their neighbors. Nobody likes that episode. I honestly don't know if I could pick just one favorite episode. But Bea Arthur could. Her favorite episode of the entire series was Season 5, Episode 18. The one where Sophia enters herself and Dorothy in the Shady Pines mother-daughter pageant. And they dress up and perform as Sunny and Cher. That was Bea Arthur's favorite episode. It is a pretty good one. Let's talk about Bea's wardrobe for the Golden Girls. I researched this segment specifically for my mom. Hi, Mom. My mom has always gushed over how much she loved Dorothy Zbornak's clothing in the Golden Girls. All four of the Golden Girls had a unique style apart from the others, and Dorothy's complemented her body so beautifully. Classy, long, flowing articles, usually in subtle earthy tones, but being the 80s, sometimes in bright, gaudy colors, complemented by big statement pieces of jewelry. The earrings were always clip-ons, though. Bea Arthur never had her ears pierced. In fact, she was quite against the idea of body piercings. Maud's wardrobe was of a similar style, just a different decade. And this is because it was Bea Arthur's style. It was a style that complemented her tall stature beautifully. And she liked to be comfortable. She liked long, flowy, long-line sweaters, comfortable slacks, flowing dresses that complemented her figure, and she loved scarves. She did not like shoes, though. She preferred sandals because she hated wearing shoes. My mom will love that because she and I are also shoe haters, which makes living in northern Minnesota a big bummer sometimes. The Golden Girls had a stylist named Judy Evan, and Bea Arthur credited her with keeping Dorothy looking gorgeous. She knew Dorothy had a dramatic side, Bea said, so she'd give me crazy earrings to wear. She was extraordinary. I would have to agree that she's extraordinary. Each one of those women were styled absolutely brilliantly to complement their characters' personalities. I cannot talk about Bea Arthur's style in The Golden Girls, though, without mentioning her wedding dress in the series finale episodes. You know the one that looks like it has toilet paper tubes taped all over it. I'm not sure whose idea that dress was, but I can tell you one thing. It made people talk, and people are still talking about it today. Bea Arthur was nominated for 4 Emmy Awards for playing Dorothy Zbornak in The Golden Girls. And in 1988, she won the Emmy for Lead Actress in a Comedy Series. Her co-stars Rue McClanahan and Betty White were also nominated. And Estelle Getty was nominated and won the Emmy for Best Supporting Actress. It was a huge year for the Golden Girls. A couple of years down the road, though, just as her gut had told her with Maude, Bea Arthur wanted to leave the Golden Girls while they were on top. Remember, she never even wanted to take on the great commitment involved with a weekly sitcom at that stage that she was at. But she was truly happy she did. But after 7 seasons, she was ready to bow out and leave the Golden Girls as the television gold it was. The final episode of the Golden Girls aired on May 9, 1992. The three others tried to keep their characters alive on a new show, The Golden Palace, but it just didn't have the same magic as the ensemble of the Golden Girls. They needed Bea. Bea Arthur easily could have retired after the Golden Girls ended, but she wanted to challenge herself in something new. She wanted to do a one-woman show. In this show, she took her audiences through the journey of her career. She told stories of her life as a struggling actor, she sang songs from her stage and screen projects, and she told jokes, some a little raunchy, according to Rue McClanahan. One thing she didn't talk about was her time in the Marine Corps. Bea's one-woman show traveled to 33 cities and ended on Broadway, to great acclaim. She was the star in the spotlight. She was the diva on the stage. She was exactly what Tallulah Bankhead said she would never be. Unfortunately, Tallulah Bankhead died before the success of Maude and the Golden Girls. But I think she knew Bea Arthur was going to make it. I think she was maybe setting a little fire under her. After Bea's one-woman show, it was time to retire. Well, mostly. And enjoy life. She spent time with her children, her grandchildren, her dear friends, and her dogs. And she contributed her time, money, and energy to causes she held close to her heart. Most prominently, animal rights organizations. She advocated for the elderly, the LGBT community, and Jewish communities. She may have been a reserved woman, but she was a passionate one. She was fiercely passionate about the things she loved. Bea Arthur was diagnosed with lung cancer in 2005. But she continued to advocate for the causes dear to her heart for as long as she was physically able. Bea Arthur lost her battle against lung cancer on April 25, 2009, at the age of 86. She lived a long and fulfilling life, but the pain of her loss still hits so sharply to so many people. The world lost a true legend the day Bea Arthur slipped away. She was more than a stage and television star. Her legacy was left everywhere she stepped. Because everywhere she stepped, she made sure to leave a little good behind. Upon her death, Bea Arthur left substantial sums of money to various charities, including $300,000 to the Ali Forney Center in New York City, an organization that provides housing and assistance to homeless LGBT youth. In 2017, the Bea Arthur Residence opened in her memory, an 18-bed home in Manhattan operated by the Ali Forney Center that provides food and shelter for homeless youth of the LGBT community. This is exactly what Bea Arthur would have wanted. Although I can say with fair certainty that if she were alive, she would have insisted that her name be kept off the home. She would have wanted to fund the project quietly. But the world has other plans. The world wants to keep the legacy of Bea Arthur alive and showcase her as the role model she was in doing good in this world. Because maybe that can inspire us to do better. I don't have any additional bullet points to share with you today, as I usually do at the end of my stories. Bea Arthur was a private woman, and I've already shared all I could about her life. There is no in-depth biography book of her, not that I could find anyways. I took what I could from the interviews I could find of her. This is the story she wanted us to know, plus the Marine part. So, in conclusion, why in the world are there zero books written about the life and legacy of Bea Arthur? Her life story is remarkable and inspiring, and I would love nothing more than to be able to read a biography of her life. But again, she was a private woman. She was an introvert. I relate to that, and I definitely would not want a book detailing every part of my life. Bea Arthur was a quiet success. She sought success for herself, for her own personal pride. She didn't necessarily want the fame. She wanted the pride of mastering her craft. She probably didn't want all of the accolades she received. She didn't need it. She worked her way to the top, and she was satisfied in doing so. Going a step further, she used that platform at the top to pay it forward to others. She knew how lucky she was, and she knew there were millions of people who struggled in life more than she could ever imagine. She was in a position to help others, and she did just that. Professionally, what she had strived for was to be the star. To be the star in the spotlight when all odds had been stacked against her because of her body and her voice. She didn't need the attention of being a star. She needed to know she could be the star. That her talent was good enough to compensate for the fact she wasn't a petite blonde starlet with a soothing soprano voice. She strived for that stardom, and she made it. And she was funny. Something she said in an interview towards the end of her life, reflecting on her successful career, was, "I've worked in so many different areas. The only things I haven't done are rodeo and porno." Bea Arthur was a true success story. But the thing she truly succeeded at, in my opinion, the thing she left the biggest footprint on, was her philanthropic work, her advocacy. She did great things for animal rights and for members of the LGBT community who struggled to survive. She saved lives, and that was something that she never wanted to be in the spotlight for. She saved lives quietly, and that is the kind of advocacy that has the most prominence. That leaves the biggest mark, because you know it is coming directly from the deepest portion of the heart. Bea Arthur's dear friend, Angela Lansbury, said this of her friend. "Bea is one of the most loyal people that you'll ever know. She is loyalty itself." Thank you, Bea Arthur, for saving human lives and for saving animal lives. Thank you for taking your position of success and using it to help others. You are a true hero. And thank you all for listening. If you are interested in some fun Stars of the Golden Age bonus content, please consider joining us over on Patreon, where, for a small monthly contribution, you can receive some fun and interesting stuff. A monthly bonus episode, a movie of the month episode, a super fun cocktail party episode, and I'll send you a Stars of the Golden Age sticker. This month's bonus episode is all about haunted Hollywood. I talk about some locations that were hot in the Golden Age and are haunted today, some by some of the hottest movie stars of their time. It's a fun and spooky episode, so come on over and check it out. You can join the fun at patreon.com/starsofthegoldenagepodcast, and there's a link in the show notes to bring you right there. Join us, and you will sleep much better at night knowing that you are supporting the production of a little independent podcast. Also, please don't forget those positive ratings and reviews where you listen to your podcasts. They really help new people discover the show, and I want to get as many ears over here that we can. You guys can help me do that. Thanks so much, guys. Reach for the positive in every day. Be kind to everyone you encounter. Be more like Bea Arthur. And have a great rest of your week. For this episode, I used Bea Arthur's own words from the Lifetime Intimate Portrait of Bea Arthur from 2002. An article from the Reserve and National Guard magazine by Carrie Williams from 2021. An article from Biography by Sarah Kettler from March 16, 2020. An article from the New York Post by Barbara Hoffman from January 28, 2002. And you better believe it, IMDb.